Case number 28501, Marvin versus Pfluger, arguing for the petitioner, Peter Van Name Esser, arguing for the respondent, David Minkin, also appearing for the respondent, Wesley Ching and Becky Chestnut, argument on the merits.
Good morning, counsel.
Good morning, your honors. I'm going to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, if I could. First, I'd like to apologize to the court for the lack of appendices attached to my petition. I filed that petition the day after the e-filing arrow struck the clerk's office, and we managed to scan one of them, the important one, the opinion itself from the ICA, but the other three appendices are not there, so you may have been confused about referencing the petition. They are all attached to the amended answering brief, and of course they're in the record. But in case you wondered why those ghost things weren't there, that's why. This is a case involving a lot of merit arguments on ahupuahas and kuleana rights and HRS 7-1. But I'm assuming that the primary issue in front of this court on cert, although I understand this court can certainly address all the issues in this case, is the issue of Rule 19 and indispensable parties. Rule 19A and necessary parties, and Rule 19B and indispensable parties, primarily focusing on 19A, because that's the way the ICA saw this case as a 19A necessary case. I only briefly want to lead off by saying, to the extent that the opposing parties have characterized this case as a Kamaaina versus Molahini case, suggesting that both the other people on the property and the ahupuaha are owned by Kamaainas, and that my clients who are originally from California 40 years ago are somehow less don't have kuleana rights under 7-1. That's not true, and to the extent that's emphasized in the record, Elizabeth Huddy, who inherited the Huddy parcel from her husband, is from Germany. Defendant Pfluger doesn't live on Kauai, and of course 7-1 applies without regard to the Hawaiian status of the parties. But it sort of sets up a prejudice that shouldn't be there. That's why I refer to it. This is not a transformational case, which is essentially what is argued by the other side. This case does not turn kuleana and ahupuaha law upside down. It essentially very carefully applies all of the cases that have come down in this court in the last 100 years, 150 years. The only real wrinkle in this case, which has been emphasized by the other side, is the partition. There's no Hawaii kuleana case that addresses the issue of kuleana partition and its effect on access and water rights. We do have the testimony of the defendant's trial expert, Bruce Graham, who indicated that my clients definitely have a right to access and a right to water under 7-1. The only question is whether or not that partition did something to the rights that either requires the participation of the Huddies in this case or completely eliminates my client's right to those kuleana rights because of the partition. There's some confusion in the record as to who has the house lot and who has the loi lot or the taro lot, and what impact that has on this case. My clients have a two-thirds share of a kuleana that was approximately an acre. So that means they have about three-quarters of an acre or two-thirds of an acre. Under the 1850 Kuleana Act, the house lots, which this presumably is on that side of the kuleana, were supposed to be no larger than one-third acre. So that means, based on the 1856 land court deed, my client clearly has a combination house lot and loi connected to it, and the Huddy lot is apparently exclusively a loi lot or a taro lot. We would argue that the Huddies arguably, they're not in front of the court today, but they arguably have no right to drinking water because drinking water essentially flows to the house lot. And my client.
Well, Mr. Esser, isn't that the ICA's point that the Huddies are not here to defend their right to, say, water, whereas it seems that the Marvins are the only ones who may be entitled to access to water.
Yes, that's their argument on Rule 19. What I'm pointing out is that because of the two-thirds, one-third split, and the fact that my client, by definition, has a house lot and part of a loy lot, that the arguments that they used on the merits, Your Honor, which is that my client had no right to irrigation water because they weren't on the loy side of the Kuleana, simply don't apply, because my client's two-thirds, by definition, has to include part loy and all house lot. So their half, this is solely in terms of their right to water, not compared with the Huddies, not excluding the Huddies. And keep in mind, the history of this case is that the Huddy lot, Heidi Yamamoto's father, Bill Huddy, actually helped put in those irrigation pipes in the ditches that brought the irrigation water down from the stream. He paid for half of those pipes and helped install them. And they shared the irrigation water.
Excuse me, what are the Huddies' rights to access?
There are a number of Kuleanas on the property, and the people using Hyena Kuleana have used different roads across the plateau in the last 40 years. Primarily, if you look at the overall testimony at the trial, they've been using a route which we call the central route, or Route 2, which goes through the center of the property and stops at a plateau. At various times, there were roads down from that plateau, trails down from that plateau, and they've changed over the years. The exact timing of the changes, we don't know. The circumstance right now is that Mr. Pfluger has built a stairway off the Polly Road, which is the last small piece of the Marvin's access, down to their house.
Do they have any legal right of access, say, from the highway to their part of the Kuleana?
They,
Huddies?
Meaning the Marvins?
The Huddies.
The Huddies have, I'm not their lawyer, but I assume they have Kuleana rights, possibly access by necessity under common law, and they probably have irrigation rights based on the fact that they're on the loy part of the property.
Those are potential rights or inchoate rights at this
I think they're not only potential, I think they're enjoying them, and they have for generations. There's no claim in front of this court that they've ever been denied. Well, that's not totally true. In 1988, Bill Huddy joined a lawsuit against Pfluger, which was not joined by my clients, which claimed a break-off of access. But that didn't involve water rights. But, I mean, as far as I know, the state of the evidence at the time of this 2006 trial was that irrigation water from Pfluger was coming down to the Huddy property, and that the debate was over a stream access on Ahwe ditches and a brook to the Marvin property. That's the state of the evidence. That's one of the things, by the way, that was found in the findings of fact, of course, which were not challenged. There were 16 findings of fact in support of Rule 19, as Your Honor, I'm sure, is aware.
None of those were challenged
in the amended opening brief.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but that's just to follow up on Justice DeCoba's question, if you could help me. In a circumstance like this, where the easement to a Kuleana is at issue at trial, how is it that the co-owner of the Kuleana parcel is not an indispensable or necessary party?
Well, the question is, are they a necessary party, not an indispensable party? A necessary party comes under three subsections of that rule. We would first of all argue that they are not co-owners. They have a separate parcel, a separate tax number, and the two separate tax numbers appear on the Pila'a 400 title report. Both show access from the road. What we, of course, argued below was that this issue was waived, Your Honor. I mean, whether or not they have there's a Rule 19 issue in this case, you have to start off with whether it was properly before the ICA and whether they set aside findings of fact that were not challenged in the amended opening brief. And in the case of water, Your Honor, assuming you are addressing both access and water, that was never argued even in the amended opening brief. The first time the issue of Rule 19 and water was ever addressed was sua sponte by the ICA. So the question is, do we go in front of the ICA where none of the findings are challenged, and they find in their opinion, in support of their ruling, that two findings are clearly erroneous, when and they say that it's plain error, by the way. They give no plain error analysis. They don't cite any of the plain error cases. They didn't argue plain error in the amended opening brief. The ICA decided to redetermine the factual issues in this case without being asked to by the defendant.
Does Pfluger's challenge of conclusion of law 12 aid them in their failure to specify the findings of fact that need to be challenged?
I'd say, first of all, that wasn't argued, so that isn't properly in front of this court either. That was not in the response to the cert petition, and it was not argued in the reply brief. But assuming you get there, the way I interpret a conclusion of law 12 is it's a conclusionary statement based on findings of fact that have already been found. It says, given the fact that there's no prejudice, which the court found, and given the fact that they expressly waive their right to appear, refuse to appear, the court finds that they are not an indispensable party. The conclusion of law in that conclusion is that they are not an indispensable party. The fact that it includes findings that have already been made doesn't turn it into a finding of fact. That's the position I take. I'll acknowledge that it would have been a little bit cleaner if the conclusion of law just simply said they're not an indispensable party. But the findings were made, and they were, like in the case of finding that they didn't want to participate, that was made four times in the findings. So challenging a conclusion of law that just mentions that the conclusion isn't sufficient.
Well, Mr. Anderson, I think the respondents argue, like they do argue, that even though that the offer was made to the Huddies to participate, or Huddy Yamamoto to participate in 2002, when the initial complaint was only for tort damages and injunctive relief, but was another offer a request made to Huddy Yamamoto after the request for access and water rights?
No, there's only one offer. But if you look at the 2002 complaint, Your Honor, this is what was requested. Preliminary and permanent injunction blocking plaintiffs, preventing defendant from blocking plaintiff's access road, diverting or in any way interfering with their water. That's 2002, which was answered without a Rule 19 affirmative defense. This is what the 1 year later third amended complaint said. Blocking plaintiffs from access road and from diverting or in any way interfering with the Marvin plaintiff's water. It's precisely the same request. The only difference is the 2002 complaint doesn't specify 7-1. It arguably was a common law remedy because there's also easements by necessity. But it's exactly, there's no reason why if the Huddies are necessary in the 2003 complaint, they weren't also necessary in the 2002. There's absolutely no difference between these two complaints except for 7-1. But let's assume it's a difference. It was a year later, and in 2003, the defendant had 3 years to file a motion to dismiss under Rule 19. They filed one objecting to the fact that Blue Water Sailing wasn't a party. They never filed one saying that the Huddies weren't a party. When they opposed the two motions, the preliminary injunction and the summary judgment motion, they said nothing about indispensable parties. They filed a position statement 5 days before the trial. The judge expressly rejected that, the part of that position statement, raising new arguments, essentially saying position statements are to state what you've already raised.
Could you have possibly, I think they claimed that they've been misled, they had been misled because the Marvins represented that they were the sole owners of the Kuleana.
No, there's, first of all, to come in front of an appellate court and make that argument with absolutely nothing in the record whatsoever, they had the parties on the stand. They had Rick on the stand, and they learned nothing at the trial, anything new. That is an argument that's been manufactured for right now. The same argument, by the way, in the amended opening brief says that somehow they were rejecting Terry Tico, that it wasn't that they didn't want to join, they just didn't like the lawyer, none of which is supported, and all they had to do is ask Heidi if that was the reason she said no. Look at what Heidi said at the trial when she was asked on cross-examination by Terry Tico. She said, no, for purposes of access, we're going to work it out with, she said nothing, by the way, about water rights. And look at the position statement and see what it says about indispensable party. Nothing whatsoever about water rights. Look at the amended opening brief. Nothing about water rights. And yet if you look at the ICA's opinion, half its opinion focuses on water rights. Again, if the ICA is simply going to take findings of fact and issues that are not argued and not challenged in the opening brief and independently decide a case, then, you know, what's the point of appellate rules? I've been sacked occasionally with appellate rules, and, you know, they're annoying when they're argued against you. But this case is has defaults across the board. They did not challenge the injunctive relief in their points.
Mr. Van Esser, so in the 2003 complaint, was that the first time Kuliana rights were mentioned?
Yes.
So up to that point, Kuliana rights were not mentioned.
That's correct.
Is that correct? And can you raise the issue of a necessary or indispensable party at any time?
There is authority to that, yes, except
you
there's
can
also
even raise it. Isn't there Hawaii authority that you can raise that on appeal?
Yes.
So that the fact that it wasn't raised, you said, before 2003, or that Blue Water Sailing apparently was the necessary or indispensable party that was identified by Pfluger, you did have, prior to any evidentiary hearing, notice that the Kuleana rights of the Huddies might be involved in the controversy.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so, but during between 2003 and 2006, was there a period of time when the action was stayed?
No.
No?
No.
It wasn't stayed because of the criminal case?
No, not that I know of.
Was discovery state at all?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
And again, if it was, Your Honor, that was not argued in the opening brief. It was not argued below. And of course, you don't know it was argued below, Your Honor, because they didn't provide you a transcript of Mr. McCorrison's closing argument. They have to present a record. And even if they raise it in the position statement, Your Honor, they did not challenge the findings of fact by the court that were reversed by the appellate court.
If you challenge a conclusion of law, can you reasonably believe that, or reasonably hold that the findings that support the conclusion of law would also be in controversy?
No.
Why not?
Because there's 16 separate findings in this case, okay? 16 separate findings of fact supported what the judge did. Carefully broke it down from prejudice to everything, and to attack one conclusion of the law, especially after the ICA has stricken the opening brief in this case for failure to even challenge a conclusion of law. And it was pointed out in the answering brief that they did not challenge any of the findings of fact. They came back and filed an amended opening brief and still failed to challenge any of the, you know, to me this case is just solid on this court's opinion in Okada. If you get a situation where you can simply ignore a wholesale default in an opening brief by saying plain error, then there's, you're not going to have any compliance with Rule 28B4 at all. And that's the concern I have.
We have recognized plain error in civil cases.
Yes, but you usually explain it in your opinion, Your Honor, and you say, here's why we did it, because the A, B, C. You don't just say it and not cite any of the relevant case law. Look at the Alvarez decision where there was a dispute between two parts of this court over and over on the issue of plain error as to whether it should be applied. And the analysis. There is not one sentence of analysis in the ICA's opinion.
Did you cite Alvarez?
No, I did not. The reason I'm pointing that out, Your Honor, is the importance of dealing with plain error on the record. And it needs to be raised in the opening brief.
Did Ms. Huddy say that she wanted to be a part of this suit?
Yes.
And so why didn't you join her?
Well, she said that 5 days before trial she had no lawyer, she had no experts, she had no discovery. What was the judge supposed to do? Cancel the case that was already, this was 2006, it was already 4 years old, 3 years old from the Kuleana complaint. Was she supposed to start discovery all over? This woman lived right next door to them and knew about this case for 4 years. So in terms of the pragmatic application of Rule 19, are they supposed to come in 5 days before trial and throw it, you know, all the experts it wasn't even argued until the first day of trial. The testimony in the first day of trial was all the major witnesses. That was when this issue was raised. There was no written opposition to it because my client didn't even have time to respond. And you're indicating, by the way, there is case law authority for raising this at any time. But there's also case law authority, not much Hawaii, but plenty of federal, which says if the other side fails to raise it, that is a justification for not going Rule 19. And if there was ever a case where it was not raised timely, it was this one. Not raised timely either by the Huddies or the defendants. Again, I understand the concern with two parties in Kuleana. And if we were in front of you and we had a Rule 19 motion and we had it ruled on and she had attempted to come into the trial and she could realistically come in with experts and actually defend herself, I don't know how she would have done it. I mean, if they had made her a party, she would have essentially shown up completely unprepared for trial, or the case would have had to be put off for another 6 months.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but posing that situation, which does seem to be undisputed, that you do have Ms. Huddy Yamamoto attempting to enter into the case on the eve of trial, and you weigh the kind of, I guess you'd say, inconvenience and waste that would take place having to delay the trial for a while to see what she was capable of coming up with to represent herself versus possibility of moving ahead with a full trial and the possibility that she's an indispensable party and the matter might end up on appeal and get hung up on appeal, wouldn't that be a reason why, in terms of the ICA's decision, they were concerned that the decision wasn't made to just back up at that point before the trial starts and allow the participation of, it seems there's evidence anyways, that she was a co-owner of a Kuleana?
I appreciate that question. The problem is she did not request to get involved in this case 5 days before. The issue was raised by a position statement. She did not testify until the third day of trial, Your Honor. We did not know that she wanted potable water and vehicular access until the case was three-fourths over.
Let me ask you, was this a trial or just an evidentiary hearing?
It was an evidentiary hearing.
So you hadn't gotten to trial yet?
That's correct.
So this was an evidentiary hearing on a motion for summary judgment?
You know, part of the difficulty, Your Honor, is that there's no transcript from the June 26th hearing.
Or a motion to dismiss, whatever it
so
was.
So the impression I got is that the parties agreed that this would be the final complete disposition of the case. We don't know what it is because they didn't request the transcript. And again, this is just another
When
default.
Was that decided?
That was decided June 26th when they first met to argue the motion for Rule 65 preliminary injunction and the motion for partial summary judgment. Again, how are you supposed to determine what was the purpose of the hearing if they don't order a simple half an hour transcript?
You could have ordered the transcript. You could have done your...
Their obligation is to prepare the record. And on October 20th, after a four-day trial and visiting the site, there was a morning of arguments as to what was being contested. And they did not order that transcript. So we don't know, like, for instance, the water issue. Did they address Rule 19 in context of the water issue on October 20th? We do not know. And I assume they didn't because it wasn't in their opening brief either. Showed up until again, is the ICA supposed to reach out, set aside findings of fact that are not challenged, address an issue which is not even raised in the opening brief, which is that water rights somehow required their participation, and take witnesses who did not testify until the third day of trial that she wanted these things, and the judge found as a matter of fact, and she's listening to this woman and she's measuring credibility, Judge Wilson, she decides on the basis of what she heard this person did not want to participate. Now, is that clearly erroneous even if you get to it? No, it's not. She decided that what she was essentially doing was she was hired by Pfluger to show up and sandbag this case by supporting Pfluger's Rule 19. I can't think of any other explanation as to why she would suddenly come in on the third day of trial and say, I want to be in this case, never having moved to intervene under Rule 22, never come in under Rule 20, but simply showed up on the third day of trial and said, surprise, I want drinking water. Her family had shared irrigation water for decades. They'd never asked. They had a catchment on the house. That was their drinking water. Now all of a sudden, she wants drinking water. I'm going to save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Minkin.
Thank you, Justices and sitting Justices. There was no trial. It was an evidentiary hearing that took place on a number of different days over a number of months and concluded with a site visit by the judge in December of 06. Mr. Esser argues that there's federal case law that says you have to hold the Pfluger entities to the strict requirements. But what Mr. Esser fails to tell you is that this is not merely a situation involving rules. It involves kuleana. It involves the rights that an individual has with a kuleana. 7-1, codified in HRS. What do we know? We know that Ms. Heidi Huddy Yamamoto was asked before the initial complaint was even filed if she wants to be part of the lawsuit dealing with the mud. Never even shown what the first complaint is, never even told 9.5, 10 months later that kuleana rights were at stake or being brought up whatsoever.
Mr. Minkin, during her testimony, didn't she indicate that when she was talking to Ms. Teagle that it was her understanding it had something to do with access?
My recollection is that she was talking about access, not kuleana rights access, but because there was some mud and blocking the pathway, and Mr. Pfluger had done something else to the Marvin access.
Well, tell me, your client never moved to add Ms. Huddy Yamamoto as a third party, never moved to dismiss for failure to join an indispensable party. Have you been sleeping on your rights?
I don't believe that we have, because
my
client's rights, that's fine, not a problem. I get blamed for a lot of things. What occurs is not until the motion for summary judgment is filed in the summer of 2006, is there any notice to the defendants that this is not a kuleana solely owned by the Marvins? It is not a kuleana that they have complete and unfettered rights to. It is a partitioned kuleana that basically was partitioned in 1965. Their parents, on an agreement of sale, bought it from the partition women.
What was the date of the motion for summary judgment?
It was June 2006, and just give me a moment.
And when did Ms. Huddy Yamamoto testify?
I believe she testified sometime in either August or September of 2006 when the hearing was set.
Are you saying Pfluger didn't know that this kuleana was a subdivided kuleana?
Not until the motion was filed.
He was under the impression that it was only owned by Pfluger? By the Marvins.
Didn't really know, because this is Pila'a 400, is almost 400 acres, and there were dozens of kuleana that were there. How people came to be there, or who owned those, who had rights to those kuleana. And that's also significant, because the deed that went to the current Marvins, to their father when the property was actually transferred in 1988, specifically indicated no access rights to Kuhil Highway, none whatsoever. That deed was based on the purchase in 1988, and then when 1996, when it was conveyed to the current Marvin brothers and their family, there again, that prohibition against access to their partitioned portion of the kuleana, to Kuhil Highway. And that's what this case is all about. They are trying to get something that they had legally contracted for that they have no right to have.
Didn't Mr. Pfluger at some point in time get on a bulldozer and bulldoze the access roads, at least one of the access roads? So he knew there was a road there.
There were three routes,
1, 2, and 3 at least.
There were multiple roads at different points in time. The question becomes now, what happens when a kuleana is partitioned? Does each partition segment of the kuleana then somehow develop their own rights under 7-1?
Well, I'm just saying, in further to Justice Okoba's question, how could he not know that that Huddy Yamamoto had was there also in addition to the Marvins, if they use different, and I believe in your briefs you mentioned they use different access roads.
Different access roads. But the access road that went to the Marvins eventually allowed them vehicular access all the way to their site. Huddy Yamamoto, the Huddys before her, her parents, her grandmother, they never had vehicular access all the way to the house site where they lived. That's the issue, that's one of the issues for us. What is going on? Why is this situation before here? And it's significant that what's at stake here is not just the procedural issues, but what are the Marvins attempting to do in this circumstance? They're attempting to gain rights that they contracted for when they received the deed in 1988 through their dad, and they themselves in 1996, that specifically prohibited any access, not vehicular of any, or any access of any type whatsoever to Cahill Highway. Coming forward in 2006 seeking vehicular access because they are Kuleana owners. But for the first time, it is pointed out that Huddy Yamamoto also owned part of that Kuleana because it was partitioned. How it was partitioned, Mr. Pfluger didn't own it in the 60s when it was partitioned. He buys it later on. He becomes the owner of the Servient land, and now what's being asked is that the Servient land, and basically the ICA hit it right on the head, should a Kuleana be subdivided, for example, into 20 partitioned lots? Does that mean that each of those 20 partitioned lots is now entitled under 7-1 to access, separate and distinct access?
Mr. Minkin, I'm not sure I understood your answer, but why didn't you join the Huddys as plaintiffs or involuntary defendants in this case?
Don't really have an answer for that, Your Honor, and that's the problem, that it was brought out in June of 2006. She testified in the fall of 2006. She indicated that she was never told that Kuleana rights were at issue.
At that hearing, she did indicate she wanted to be involved when
Correct.
Asked with respect to access and water rights. Did your position paper raise the question of water rights or only access?
My recollection is that it only raised access rights at that time.
Okay. But during the hearing, water rights came up because
she indicated
the Marvins were seeking access to,
Correct.
To water. Is that right?
Yes.
Based on what was presented at the hearing, because this is essentially one Kuleana, was there enough or was it possible to obtain information that would have enabled the court within that proceeding? I think she went over 4 months or longer.
Correct.
To have decided the rights of the Huddys and the Marvins with respect to access and water.
I think that would have been possible given the fact that it was an evidentiary hearing and the court itself conducted a site inspection.
What more needed to be decided? You have one Kuleana. Didn't the expert for the Marvins testify about the history of that Kuleana and where the Huddys were getting their water from and where the Marvins were getting their water from and the three access paths or roads to the Kuleana?
I think that there was expert testimony both from Mr. Graham, from Dr. Andrade, and then also recipient witness Fred Trotter, who had been the manager for C. Brewer back in that area in the 50s and early 60s, as to what was happening and what was going on and how certain roads and certain access only came about when a movie was being filmed, a Frank Sinatra movie was being filmed there in the early 60s. The problem occurs is that the judge, and this is our position, that the judge had the ability to bring her, Ms. Huddy Yamamoto, into the case as a party. And the judge basically determined that wasn't going to be necessary. That
well, doesn't Rule 19 mandate the court to do that if that person fits within the criteria under
Correct.
19A?
Correct, absolutely.
So the obligation's on the court.
Correct.
Although certainly the parties have some responsibility.
Correct, and that's why the rule allows either bring her in as a plaintiff party, or if need be, bring her in as a defendant party, similar to quiet title actions where notice is given to every possible person that your property rights, not personal rights that go with you, but rights that are attendant to the actual parcel of land, may be at stake or in controversy. And that's what the court should have done in this case, and the court did not do it.
Mr. Minkin, question. Mr. Esser has told us that because the Marvins owned two-thirds of the Kuleana, that necessarily that means part of the land was Loy and part of it was household. Do you agree with that?
That's the first time I've heard that.
Well, he made it as part of his argument, though.
Correct.
What do you say to that?
That may be true. I don't know enough about if that's actually true or not.
Okay.
Mr. Rankin,
yes.
What is the standard of review that we should apply in reviewing what Judge Watanabe did?
I believe that the ICA hit it on the head with plain error mm-hmm. in this particular case, because as Justice Acoba indicated, doesn't the court also have the responsibility to make sure, and I believe it was sitting Justice Wilson talked about, wouldn't it have been better to resolve this matter at the evidentiary stage versus having it come up on appeal? And isn't that what the issue for the ICA was? Shouldn't it have been taken care of with her being a participant in the matter?
But whether it's better or not, or would have been more efficient or not, what is the standard of law that would apply to our reviewing her actions?
I believe that it's an abuse of discretion, and I believe plain error.
Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Minkin, you plainly didn't challenge the findings of fact that underlay the conclusion of Law 12. Why should we consider your arguments when you didn't bolster them by...
Understood. And that is problematic. But if you look at conclusion of Law 12 and you look at finding of fact 102 and 104, they are mirror images of conclusion of Law 12. Basically, it is the conclusion that there is no prejudice. There is nothing that delineates why there would be no prejudice, as a finding of fact should be, that she had knowledge, she had this or that, but that's all it is. 102 and 104 are mirror images of conclusion of Law 12. And I
the
believe
fact that there was no prejudice seems somewhat irrelevant, doesn't it, under the law? The fact that you have permission to use land that's not supported by some legal obligation doesn't defeat the right to request access to be established under 7-1.
Correct, absolutely, because that may be something that is just personal to Ms. Hari Yamamoto, but the reality is 7-1 doesn't deal with the individuals, it deals with the parcel of land, and that's correct.
And so I gather think this court has held that, hasn't it, that the fact that, you know, you have permission to use the land doesn't defeat a request to assert a right-of-way under 7-1.
Correct.
So is it your position that as soon as Ms. Hari Yamamoto expressed an interest in participating as a witness, I guess, at the hearing, that would have justified or compelled Judge Watanabe to continue the matter and allow her to participate?
Yes.
Well, help me with that, Mr. Minkin. It seems finding of fact 90 indicates that the court found that Ms. Hari Yamamoto specifically declined to participate in the case. So if that is true, your position is that Judge Watanabe should have nonetheless sua sponte joined her.
The question becomes, when does that reference her declination of participation? And our argument is that it was before the initial complaint was even filed. So what was told to her by then counsel Terry Tico, what complaint, we have no information whether the complaint, as Mr. Esser argued, somehow covers some of these access issues, was ever even shown to Ms. Hari Yamamoto. And then there's nothing in the record whatsoever that she knew that her Kuleana rights were at play or in stake.
All
and
right.
then at the evidentiary hearing,
okay.
She said she wanted to participate.
All right, then what I understand you to be saying is that finding of fact is just not correct.
Correct.
Mr. Minkin, Ms. Hari Yamamoto was your witness, right?
Correct. Under subpoena.
Okay. Somewhere along the way, you found out that she was owner of a third of the Kuleana. Is that correct? Is it in the record when you, you said that your client had no knowledge of it until the motion for summary judgment, which was in June.
When Ms. Tico for the first time indicated that her clients were not the owner of the Kuleana, that they were owners of a partition portion of the Kuleana.
And you're saying that your client had no knowledge of Hari Yamamoto before that motion was filed?
No, he had knowledge of Huddy Yamamoto, but didn't know how the Kulianas broke up on the property or whether it was the same Kuleana or separate Kulianas, because this is almost a 400-acre parcel on the Mackay side of Kuhil Highway with dozens of Kuleana going back to the 1800s.
So your client had no knowledge that Huddy Yamamoto was owned one-third of the Kuleana that
Correct.
The Marvins had? And from June to the time of the, somehow you were in contact with her to serve her.
Had a service process to serve her, correct.
And, but there was no?
There was no attempt by us to have the court or bring her in through a third party complaint. Yes, that's correct. We didn't do anything affirmative to bring her into the lawsuit, as neither did the plaintiffs, nor the court when presented with that information.
Or file a motion to dismiss for failing to. Is it your testimony that when you put her on the stand, you didn't know what she was going to say?
I wasn't present at the hearing. My understanding is that she indicated that she wanted access and water rights, and that's what she testified to, and Ms. Tico cross-examined her.
If the court was going to enter an order, as it did, determining where access should be, in other words, draw an easement, then the court, knowing, or it seems, it doesn't seem disputed, that the Kulianas, maybe, it is disputed, entitled to only one access, because we look at the Kuleana, then the court would have to take into consideration the interests of the Huddies. Right, because they're assuming it's one Kuleana, you have one access, the court could not issue a just decision unless it took into consideration how this access would affect everyone who occupied the
Correct.
Kuleana.
Correct, absolutely.
And so this was an interest that Rule 19 covers, someone whose interest might be adversely affected. And in the future, if, for example, the Huddies decide that they don't like the Marvins Kuleana, or the Marvins don't want the Huddies using, I'm sorry, their right of way, or the Marvins don't want the Huddies using their right of way, or the Huddies pass their property off to someone else who decides they don't want the Marvins right of way, or the Marvins don't like whoever the Huddies successors are, then we're looking at potentially future litigation.
Correct.
And depending on how that turns out, that means the Pfluger property, or whoever succeeds to the Pfluger property, would also be burdened additionally if access were required in addition to the access already established in this case. So does that fall all within Rule 19?
I believe that it does. And
so does it make any difference? I mean, we're talking about when you filed, and was it untimely? That kind of thing, when really Rule 19 is aimed at the court issuing an order that takes into consideration the interests of all the parties that might be involved and attempts to avoid future unnecessary litigation.
I think that's absolutely true, and I think what's further compounding the problem from our perspective is that testimony of one of the Marvin brothers that he would not grant Heidi Huddy Yamamoto access across their access route to their property. And with all of that taken into consideration, it's to me the fact that she wasn't afforded the opportunity, whether by us, by the plaintiffs, or even by the court, with all of this sitting before the court, basically.
So the court had this testimony from Ms. Huddy saying she wanted water rights, she wanted access. But the court's decision didn't address any of that, even though that was evidence received at the hearing.
Correct.
So how can the court decide where that easement should lie? Because the easement, as I understand it, only goes from the road to the Marvin's property.
That's correct.
And it doesn't go to the Huddy's property.
That's absolutely
so
true.
So in effect, the Huddy's have no legal access to their portion of the Kuleana under this decision.
That is true. That is the problem, because the Kuleana rights go to the parcel. It doesn't go to individuals, and then it comes into that subdivided scenario again, that if you subdivide the parcel, which has rights under 7-1, is every subdivision part of that entire parcel now going to be entitled to 7-1 rights, which would then basically prejudice and work an unconstitutional taking against the Servian landowner.
What was Hari Yamamoto's reason for declining to participate in the lawsuit?
In the very beginning? Mm-hmm. My understanding is that she was told that it dealt with the mudslide.
Was there any indication that she had an understanding already with Pfluger that granted her access?
Her parents before her had worked out something with some of the issues regarding water and access, but that was a separate agreement that was reached with the Servian landowner, not anything asserted under 7-1.
Well, you're not saying that she absolutely didn't have any access to her property. She did have access.
She did not have vehicular access. She had
pedestrian
access.
There was a stairway that she went down.
Correct.
And she was getting water, wasn't she?
Yes. But the question, as Justice Okoba indicated, what happens later? What happens if another owner comes in, either of the parcel, the Hari Yamamoto parcel, or of Pila'a 400?
So if the one-third owner of the Kuleana weren't Hari Yamamoto and testified, I've got a great relationship with Pfluger, and I have every confidence we're going to work it out, and I absolutely do not want to be a part of this. I don't have the money to hire a lawyer. I don't have the time. I don't want to be a part of it. Are you saying the court still has an obligation to bring that person in?
Yes, because this is Kuleana rights. It goes back to HRS. What is being done here? If you and I have a handshake agreement and something, and I step off the curb and get hit by a bus, how do you enforce that agreement against me? And that's the problem. How do you guarantee those access rights that 7-1 permits?
The water to the Huddy portion of the Kuleana was piped in, was it not? Hadn't the pipes been laid for that before?
It was piped in, correct.
Where did Mr. Pfluger participate in that, or was that before his ownership?
My understanding is that at some point in time he did participate in it, and I don't know how it existed or what existed prior to his ownership of it.
So presumably they must have had some kind of an agreement whereby water was piped to Huddy.
Correct.
And it's drinking water.
Correct.
Right, okay.
Justice.
The other side of the equation is interest, and it would be the surrounding landowner's interest in avoiding future litigation in terms of whether or not there would be additional burdens on the land. Is that right?
Correct.
Do you recall the case that indicates the fact that there is permission given by the surrounding landowner to Kuleana for access does not bar the court allowing a right-of-way under 7-1?
I don't recall it offhand. If I may have a brief moment to check with my brain trust.
That's it.
No. If there are no further questions, I have nothing else at this time.
One more, Mr. Meekin, if you don't mind. Why wasn't the Rule 12 motion filed, I mean, rather than the statement that you filed in June of 2006?
Truthfully, from practicing in that court, if from the moment that information was available with a hearing date set in August, if I filed the motion the very next day after the motion for summary judgment, I would not get a hearing date till well after that motion for summary judgment. That's the problem I face as a litigator in the courts, sometimes on the outer islands.
Even if it's the same judge that's handling it?
Correct. There are certain time periods that are blocked out, and because they handle criminal and civil matters simultaneously, criminal has precedent. There are certain times that are set weekly for substantive motions in civil cases. They get bumped if there's a criminal trial going on, and if there's a civil trial going on, you still run the risk of getting bumped from a substantive motion that's set up on the motions day.
That's interesting, because it seems to me, from a practical point of view, a motion to dismiss could be heard at the same time as a motion for summary judgment.
Correct. I can only give you my own experience where I've been involved with other parties for motions, and we have stipulations to continue the hearing for a date certain, because there may be a pending trial and witness unavailability, and myself and other parties have both had to show up, go on the record, and make that request orally in the Fifth Circuit rather than submitting stipulations. And that doesn't bode well for the clients when they have to pay for lawyers if both are coming from Honolulu, when it's easily agreed to by stipulation, but that's the constraints we're working under.
Regardless of when the motion to dismiss would have been heard under your Rule 12, wouldn't it have been the better practice to at least file it to preserve your rights?
In hindsight, absolutely. In hindsight, definitely true. Thank you.
Mr. Mankin, I'm sorry. I just wanted to be clear. This is a determination that was made by the trial judge after the trial judge had an opportunity to hear evidence, correct?
Correct.
And then she exercised her, discretion that's supposed to be discretion exercised with an equitable determination as to whether an indispensable party should be added, and then made specific findings why it was she didn't feel that the equities ought to include this particular indispensable party or this particular party, partly because that party said she didn't want to be there. So your viewpoint is that notwithstanding that kind of analysis, the court had an obligation to add Ms. Hadi Yamamoto as an indispensable party.
In 2002, she said she didn't want to be there. In 2006, when she knew that access and water rights were at stake, she testified under oath that she wanted to be a party and part of that particular evidentiary process as a party, not just the witness.
What about Mr. Esser's view that it was a matter of credibility and the judge didn't believe her?
When someone says they want to be a party, that's a red flag. The equities indicate, based upon the rules, that someone should take responsibility for that. Ms. Hadi Yamamoto said she wanted to be part of it because she knew that her access and water rights were at stake. The court basically said, no prejudice. How you can do that when this is Kuleana 7-1 and say that, sorry, you have rights under 7-1, but I'm going to make determinations that are going to cut off those rights, and there's no prejudice to you, that's unfathomable to me.
How much time does Mr. Esser have? All right. You can take five.
Okay. Briefly, one of the things that concerns me, opposing counsel is a good friend of mine and a completely honest, straightforward lawyer. But one of the things that concerns me about his explanation as to why that motion was filed, Justice Duffy, and what they did below, is it's relying on facts that are not in the record. I really strongly object to that. If they wanted to make a record that they could bring up on appeal as to the supposedly just finding out about Kuleana's at the last minute, and Justice Nakayama asked some good questions. How do you have an expert like Bruce Graham, who wrote an expert report and shows up and explains the whole history of this thing, including, by the way, Justice Akoba, a 2001 title report that lists the two separate parts of Hyena Kuleana with separate tax numbers, which makes absolutely clear that there's a partition action there. Now, saying he has 20 Kuleanas and he doesn't care and doesn't know, there's no record whatsoever that they didn't know. Their expert knew. His whole argument was that partition screwed this thing up. And obviously, Bruce Graham didn't wait until he talked to him.
What happens in the future if someone brings an action, someone say, the Huddies, or someone who succeeds to the Huddies, and says, well, I want access and I want water rights?
I would take this position, and I appreciate that question. There is absolutely no evidence in the record in front of this court that Huddy is ever going to sue them or do anything about it. She hasn't. Neither she nor her family have done it since 1988.
So they
sued
once.
Speculating,
they sued
Your
once
Honor.
Before.
And I will say this: that is a non-exclusive easement over the central part of this ahupua'a.
Well, I'm just asking, Mr. Van Ness.
It is a non-exclusive easement. It does not rule on Huddy's rights on water at all. Nothing in this ruling affects her. And it is nonsense to say that the judge simply found there's no prejudice and didn't explain it. Look at the 16 findings. She explains exactly why there's no prejudice. She talks about what the water rights were and what the access rights were and exactly why she found no prejudice. And we argued in the cert petition and in the answering brief that on the merits, forget about the late raising, forget about the fact that he didn't file a Rule 12 motion. On the merits, this is not a necessary party. There's no evidence in front of this court, and they didn't get any evidence from her. Having her show up on the third or fourth day of trial and say, oh, suddenly I want to participate, is not evidence that the judge has stopped everything.
In 1988, didn't the Huddys sue for access and water rights?
That finding is in the findings.
All right. And they apparently didn't get it, or else it's not in the record.
You cannot say they apparently didn't get it.
Well, it's not in the record. We don't know. Right?
That you don't therefore assume nobody, they didn't get it. At the time of the trial, they had irrigation water, and he built their stairway. Now, where did he build that stairway, Justice Acova? Off the Pauley Road. The only way they could even use that stairway was to walk down the Pauley Road and go down that stairway. And what did their expert, Leland Lee, propose at the trial? He testified a third route. Do you remember that evidence at the trial? He testified they should go down the Pauley Road, the Huddys, and go across the Marvin property. They proposed using the Pauley Road. They did not object to the Pauley Road. They wanted it used. And their expert got up there and said, these people, despite the partition, have a right to water and access. That's in the record. This was a non-exclusive easement. Go to the last page, or for that matter, go to the judgment, and look at the three things this judge ordered. It is absolutely misstates the record to say that somehow she tied the hands of Huddy. Huddy can do whatever they want. Nothing in this record ties Huddy's hands.
Yeah, exactly. They can sue in the future for the same water rights and access that was not decided in this case. And apparently what they sued for back in 1988, and apparently we have
no
legal disposition.
That was not water.
Okay, access.
And again.
The same access rights that apparently they raised during the Marvin's hearing, and there is a potential possibility that can be raised again in the future.
She did not testify she wanted to sue Pfluger. Not a whisper.
If she had showed up on the day of trial and said that she wanted to be a part of the lawsuit, wouldn't Judge Watanabe practically have been obligated to continue the trial regardless of the hearing, the multi-day hearing, regardless of the expense, and allow her to participate?
No, because she was issuing non-exclusive easement over two. She did not preclude any rights of the Huddys whatsoever in this. She found that as a matter of law. I mean, of law and fact. That finding is binding on this panel. It wasn't objected to. It wasn't challenged. Whether there was prejudice or not was not challenged, and it is not true that it was a conclusion of law. It was a finding of fact. She explained why. She said, nothing I'm doing here today is going to limit the Huddys' rights whatsoever, and there's no evidence in the record. She did not say that she didn't know about this until 6 weeks ago, this argument that's been trumped up here. They didn't file a Rule 12 motion because they were afraid they were going to lose on the merits, and this was their last minute attempt to jump in.
That's not in the record either.
My time's up.
Yeah. Thank you.
There are so many misstatements in this record, it drives me crazy. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Minister. There being no further business, this court stands adjourned.